Part 2 of the series of the early life of Moshe. Moshe ran away from Egypt, and unlike what most stories tell about instantly about him arriving in Midian, which is in the east of Egypt, the northeast of Egypt, further east than Israel, what actually happened was Moshe first ran south. He joined Kuknos' army for 9 years, and the end when Kuknos died, still unable to get into his capital city, Moshe was appointed as the king. He reconquered the capital city, chased away Bilam, his two sons and eight brothers who had taken over the capital. Now that Moshe wasn't in Egypt anymore, Bilam ran back to Egypt. Egypt was now a place that he wanted to be at because he wasn't worried about the threat called Moshe. And he began to instigate an incredible amount of problems for the Jewish people who all living in Egypt at the time. And Moshe got the country back in order. He quashed rebellions of people who believed that Moshe wouldn't have been as effective a leader as the previous king. And the previous king's widow was given to Moshe as a wife, as was the custom in those days. Moshe was 27 years old when he became the king of Cush. This is 9 years after he ran away from Egypt, at least according to the calculation that we're going based on. He ruled the kingdom for 40 years. There are opinions that say 60, but he ruled the kingdom for 40 years extremely successfully. He conquered many other countries. He took the Cush army and led them to very successful battles, not just against the vassal states that had already been established earlier by earlier kings, but Moshe also made new wars and new victories. One of the more famous ones was a victory against the kingdom of Edom, who are descendants of Esav, who are essentially related to Moshe and to the Jewish people. And Moshe won those wars very successfully. His wife, who he didn't actually marry, was officially appointed to him. It was the widow of the earlier king. As far as everyone was concerned, Moshe was married to her, but Moshe didn't actually stay with her in any capacity. Aside for the fact that she was officially his wife, no one knew any different, and I'm guessing that she probably didn't advertise it, but Moshe understood that he needed to marry someone that was among the Jewish people, and for that reason, he was never with her in any capacity. And for 40 years, he ran the country with extreme piety and gathering extreme respect from the entire empire of Cush, and the whole time, he wasn't with his official wife. He was never with her. And finally, after 40 years, she instigated a coup. And the question is, depending on different sources, whether she actually made that coup in front of him or she went behind his back and instigated the coup. But whatever the case was, she came to the council of Cush and she told him, number one, she said, Moshe has never married her. Number two, he doesn't worship our gods. And number three, we have a king who isn't from our flesh. He's not a native of Cush. He's a foreigner. It's time for us to do off with him. We need to find a new person. And she said, I have a son who's now, now over 40 years old. It was Kuknus's actual son who was a young child at the time when his father died and trapped outside the capital walls. And she says, now he's a wise and in middle-aged man. Let's appoint him as the king. He has the rightful position, and let's get rid of Moshe. The people were so both terrified of Moshe and also in such a deep state of respect. They considered Moshe to be more angel-like than human. They had such a respect, and it says about Moshe that he had a glow that came from his face. And when people looked at him, they felt just a deep sense of respect. He was such a moral, upstanding person that people couldn't help but have incredible respect for him. The elders of Cush gathered together. They gave gifts to Moshe the following morning after appointing Muncham Umunachrim as the king, and they sent Moshe off with an incredible amount of wealth, but it was a very strange situation, as we're going to see in a bit, because people in those days, kings in those days, the only way their kingdom ended, the only way their reign ended was with death, whether they died naturally or they were killed. You never had a story of a king that just left. In Moshe's case, they couldn't kill him. They couldn't get themselves to hurt him. They had sworn fealty to them, and these were noble and upstanding people who felt do to the word that they had given Moshe, and he had been such a faithful ruler and leader, and so they decided it was only just that they didn't hurt him, but rather gave him gifts and accompanied him out of the city, and Moshe didn't put up a fight. He agreed, and he left. Exactly like that. Now, Moshe understood the people who wanted his life, Dothan and Aviram, who had originally slandered him to Pare, and the Pare, they were all still very much alive. Dothan and Aviram were still exceptionally wealthy and powerful men. Moshe knew he couldn't yet head to Egypt, even though so many years had gone by. Moshe was now 67 years old. He'd been leading Cush for 40 years. He still wasn't able to return home. And so instead of traveling north back to Egypt, he headed northeast instead. Now, Moshe had a problem. He was 67 years old and had no children, had no wife. And so he thought back into his own history, you know, his ancestors, and he realized that so many successful marriages had happened to the Jewish ancestors by a well. So he said, well, if that's the case, let me go to a well and I'll hang around the well. Hopefully I'll find a bride by the well. It's really interesting to note that Moshe's life was very much like that. He always drew inspiration from Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. He always wanted to emulate them. If he found behavior that he liked in history, in his own history that he had experienced until that day, he would try to follow it and copy it as much as possible, because he understood that learning from the greats in history is such a successful recipe for having a successful life. So he said, Yitzchak himself didn't go. Eliezer, the servant of Avram, was the one that was sent. But the wife had been found by the well, and that story was very well known. Yet later, Yaakov, when he's running away from Esav, goes to the well and meets his future wife, Rachel, by the well. Moshe was convinced, let me just emulate the greats and let me do exactly the same thing. So at the age of 67, he arrives in Midian, and he stands far away from the well, but close enough to watch the well. And he waits. He's waiting for, you know, his own miracle to happen, his own bride to show up. In the city where he arrived in Midian, there was a very powerful man by the name of Yisroi. Yisroi had been an Egyptian advisor. According to the way I understand it, he was Egyptian himself. And of course, when he told Paroi not to kill the Jewish people and not to slaughter their children or throw their children into the river, Paroi became very displeased with Yisroi. And Yisroi understood that it was time for him to leave or he would be dead. So he escaped, and he didn't know where to go. He went to Midian, but on his way out, he decided to go for a little thievery. He decided to go to kind of grab whatever he can on his way out in order to, you know, take whatever he wanted. In Paro's treasure room, he had exceptional treasures, the rarest treasures in the world. Remember, Egypt at that time was the powerhouse of the world. One of the treasures was one of the most amazing artifacts that ever existed. Paro had stolen the artifact himself, but this artifact was in Paro's treasure house, and Yisroi, on his way out, decided he was going to steal it. What was it? Right after the 6 days of creation, God had created the world and created the land and the sea and the animals and the fish and all the different creatures. And then human beings, Adam and Chava, were created. And then right before Shabbos, the seventh day came in, because the seventh day was a day of rest and Hashem stopped creating the world, a bunch of interesting artifacts were created. One of the more famous ones is the donkey that Mashiach is going to ride on. It's the same donkey that's still alive to this day from the sixth day of creation. It's the same donkey that that Avram used when he brought his son to the Akedah to slaughter him. He didn't actually put his son on, but he put the belongings onto the donkey. It's the same one that Moshe is going to use later on in this story, that he used to bring his family on the way to Egypt. One of the artifacts that were created was a sapphire stick, the stick that had so many mystical secrets engraved on it, and it was given as a gift to Adam. Interestingly enough, one really amazing thing that was created was tongs. And the reason why tongs were created is because in order to create a pair of metal tongs, you need to melt it in fire. But in order to melt it in fire, you need to hold it over the fire without your hands getting burnt. So the first set of tongs had to have been created by God, because no human being could have created an effective, properly melted pair of tongues without having to first use a tongue to hold that tongue. So the first set of tongues were created by God, but a whole bunch of very interesting artifacts were created by Hashem right before before Shabbos came in. And one of them was a sapphire stick. And the sapphire stick was given to Adam as a gift. And then Adam and Chava both ate from the tree, and they were banished from the Garden of Eden after Shabbos. They spent the first Saturday, the first Shabbos in the Garden of Eden in Gan Eden. And then they were banished from the garden. And when they were banished, Adam, the first man, took this sapphire stick out with him. It was what he carried. And he gave it as a gift to one of his descendants, a bunch of generations later, a very righteous man by the name of Chanoich. Chanoich gave it. There's different opinions of who it transferred, whether it transferred to Noach and then to Shem or straight to Shem. But Noach, the man that famously made the ark, was a righteous man, and he inherited that stick, and he gave it to his son Shem, who in turn saw Avraham Avinu, Abraham. And he gave that gift to Abraham. That stick went to Avraham. Avraham gave it to his son Yitzchak. Yitzchak gave it to his son Yaakov. Yaakov gave it to Joseph, to Yosef. It was like a special gift because he considered Yosef to be he was the oldest son of Rachel. He considered him to be, his firstborn to a degree. And so part of his double portion was this incredible gift of the staff, the sapphire stick that was created by God and given to Adam in Gan Eden. When Yosef died, however, it didn't go to his children because Yosef was the most powerful man alive after King Paro. But when he died, Paro kind of just took control of Yosef's estate. Seeing a sapphire stick that was priceless, it's made out of sapphire, it was massive, we'll talk about that in a moment. It was an artifact without any possible price tag on it. And so Paro confiscated it and put it into his own treasure house. And at that point, it no longer stayed among the Jewish people. Yisro had been eyeing it. And now that he was forced to run for his life from Egypt, well, he said, this is a perfect opportunity for me to kind of grab it and run. And that's exactly what he did. He was an incredible magician. He broke into the treasure houses of Paro. He took the stick and he ran with the stick. Now the stick, in addition to being exceptionally expensive, had a few other characteristics that made it rather fascinating. Number one, its weight. Its actual weight was tremendous. It was, based on estimates of how it's described in the Hebrew measurements, it was somewhere around 650 pounds. That's the size, that's the weight of three grown men. It was exceptionally heavy, and it was made out of, the whole thing was made out of sapphire. But what another very interesting thing about it was its engravings. It was engraved with tremendous secrets on it. Secret names of God were engraved around the stick. The name of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, the forefathers, was already engraved on the stick. Remember, this stick had been made many, many years before Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were even born. The 12 Shvatim, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zevulun, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, Yosef, Binyamin, the 12 sons of Yaakov were all engraved into the stick. The six mothers, which is Sarah, the wife of Avram, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah, but also Bilhah and Zilpah, because Yaakov married four wives. Essentially, the four mothers of the six mothers of the Jewish people were all engraved into it. And also 10 mysterious letters, which now we know what they mean, but back in those days, I'm assuming it confused many people. It was abbreviations that spelled out the Tzach Adash Be'achav. And of course, most people had no idea what that meant. But that's a 10-letter abbreviation of the 10 plagues. Moshe is going to later on use a stick. Spoiler alert. Moshe is going to use the stick when he goes to Paro. It's going to be this stick that he's going to deploy in order to as his stick to punish the Egyptians and free the Jewish people. And of course, it came by way of God, but God instructed him to use the stick. And that's this stick. But it hasn't yet come into Moshe's possession yet. Yisro grabbed it because of how unbelievably rare and expensive it was. He grabbed the stick and he ran for his life to Midian. He comes to Midian, and very quickly Yisro rises through the ranks of the expert idol worshippers and magicians and knowledgeable people of the of Midian until he becomes the official high priest of Midian. He was so wise and so knowledgeable in every cult and every idol worship and every form of magic, every dark type of secret and art form and knowledge that there was to know. Yisro knew it all. In brackets, this is the reason why later on when he converted to Judaism, after the whole story of the Egyptian redemption, it was such a big deal because the whole world knew the name Yisro. Everyone knew that no one knew idol worship better than Yisro. And when he left it and became a Jew and joined the Jewish people, it was such a dramatic statement because they were like, well, if anyone knows everything, it's Yisro. And if he joins the Jewish people, it's a very large statement. But he flew through the ranks until he was appointed the high priest of Midian. And then he became old. And as he got old and wise, he started realizing that idol worship was nonsense. Bowing down to sticks and stones and to gold and silver. The whole thing was ridiculous. And yes, it came along with incredible real powers that people were able to do. Magic in those days, unlike today, was something, was a force that people genuinely used and were able to create incredible and do incredible things with. Yisro began to realize that it has to be something deeper than it all. And he realized, not yet the truth, but he was able to identify falsehood at this point. And he realized that all of this idol worship that he had dedicated his life and knew so much about was all nonsense. And so he couldn't just announce, you know, this is all ridiculous, I'm out. And he would get killed. And he would get banished, and he would go through so much shame and rejection. So he decided to be much more diplomatic about it, and he made an announcement. He told the rest of all the people that were involved in the different cults of idol worship that existed in that time, that all respected him as their leader. He told them simply, he said, I'm an old man. I'm done. I gave so many good years to the causes, all the different causes of idol worship. I want to now just enjoy my retirement, and I'm out. And he hoped that they would just be happy with his quiet resignation and his, you know, living the rest of his life. And he was a very old man at this point. It's different counts of how you could count his life. But according to all of them, he would have been a very old man at this point. And he didn't denounce the idols. He didn't come out against it. He just said, I'm an old man. I'd like to retire. Of course, they saw right through it. And he began to get the full brunt of a boycott, of rejection. They were furious at him. They disconnected him from all the gold and silver and all the assets that he had connected with all the different idol worships. And they went on a full-blown boycott of him. They said no one's to work with him, no one's to talk to him, no one's to have anything to do with him. If he wants to reject the idols, that's fine, but we'll have absolutely nothing to do with him. And they started to hound him, and they refused to even getting an employee to watch his sheep. He was unable. That's how rejected he was. No one was even willing to work for pay or have anything to do with him. He had seven daughters. And the only people who he could get to watch his sheep was his seven daughters. In those days, shepherds would go out into the wilderness. Making one's daughter as a shepherd was an extremely, extremely dangerous job because the girls would be alone in the middle of the wilderness all by themselves with just sheep. They had no protection. And Yisro had no choice. That was it. He had no livelihood left. All he had was sheep. He had no one to watch the sheep. And so his daughters were the shepherds, but they played it very carefully. Instead of going to the well to water the sheep and to get, you know, to make sure that the sheep aren't going to die of thirst, they would go very early in the morning. That way they could avoid when all the rest of the shepherds were there. They were very worried about harassment and about being persecuted by the other shepherds. So they'd go very early in the morning, they would water the sheep, and then before the rest of the shepherds would show up, they would already be gone. And that way they would avoid detection and they'd avoid harassment. The day that Moshe showed up to Yisro, well, to Midian, the seven daughters of Yisro were running late. And the timing was dreadful. When they showed up to the well, so all the rest of the shepherds were there. They saw the daughters of Yisro, and they were excited. This was a chance to all the malicious ideas that they had in their mind of what they wanted to do to Yisro's daughters. Well, that was it. The girls were right there next to the well without anyone to protect them. And so they started to harass the daughters of Yisro. And Yisro's daughter started screaming. And I'm going to follow one of the interpretations of how the chain of events happened. But we'll read it according to one way, how to read the verse. The gulls started screaming, and the screaming chased away the shepherds. They were so startled by the screaming and the shouting and the drama, but they gathered their wits, and they realized that they have no one to stop them from doing harassment, and the plans of what they wanted to do to Yisro's daughters became a little more vicious and a little more sinful, let's call it. And they took the gulls and they threw them in a pit with intention of very dreadful behavior to follow. And Moshe's watching this all. And you have to remember, Moshe was not a regular man. He wasn't just a nice chap until he became a prophet. He was an incredibly righteous man, but he was a man with incredible vision. And he looked into the daughters of Yisro, seeing right through them themselves, seeing their past and seeing everything about them, just as they had done with the Egyptian taskmaster, the slave driver who he had killed many, many years earlier. And he saw the story of these girls and saw why they were getting harassed and realized their father had rejected idols. And this is the reason that they were getting harassed. And Moshe was very inspired by all this. So he came to the well, he pulled the girls out of the well, essentially saving their lives. And while they were drying off from being inside the well, Moshe began to water their sheep. You know, helping them get through the process of watering their sheep and on their way as quick as possible. It's really interesting to see, you know, the similarities between Moshe and his ancestor many times over, seven or so times over, Rivka, who also was by the well, and this time in reverse, Rivka is the one that watered the sheep of Eliezer, the servant of Avram. Moshe watered their sheep, and they were extremely grateful. And Moshe told them, "Don't thank me, thank the Egyptian." And they asked him what he meant, and he told them like this. He said, "Let me give you an example. There was once a man who got bitten by a wild donkey. And in those days, there was a belief, and I don't know if these wild donkeys exist or what the meaning behind this belief is, but there was a belief like this, that if a person got bit by a certain type of wild donkey, the only remedy he had was to get to water before the wild donkey got there. If he got to the water before, he would survive and the donkey that bit him would die, but if the donkey got to the water first, then he would die from the wild donkey bite and the donkey would survive. So Moshe tells the daughters of Yisro, there was once a man who got bit by a wild donkey and rushed to the water as quick as possible. He made it on time and he's inside the water and he's bathing and he's happy he survived. And as he does that, he notices there's a young child who's drowning in the river. So quickly he rushes to the child, saves the child's life, and the child's so grateful. He says, "Thank you so much for saving my life." And the man says, "Don't thank me, thank the wild donkey, because had the wild donkey not bitten me, I would never be here." Moshe told the same thing to the daughters of Yisro. He says, "You're thanking me for saving your life now and, you know, pulling you out of the way of the shepherds that were trying to do dreadful things. But the truth of the matter is, had the Egyptian not tried to kill the Jewish slave in Egypt, well, I would never have gone to Cush for 60 or 40 years and have never come here. And, you know, so really, who do you owe your thanks to? You owe your thanks to that Egyptian man all the way back in Egypt." Moshe was also trying to teach them that it wasn't really me that saved your life. It's God that placed me here. God orchestrated all the events that I could have show up to Midian exactly the time when you guys would need help. And Moshe told them as much, that it's in the merit of your father's dedication to truth that enabled God to send me here in this moment to save you from persecution of these shepherds. What's really interesting, though, Medrash Rabbah brings it down, I believe the Mahazul comments on it, that Moshe, after giving water to the daughters of Yisro, Moshe then proceeded to water the shepherds' sheep as well. Moshe believed that the reason why these young men had behaved in such a despicable way was because they'd never seen a sign of goodness in their life. So instead of what you would imagine, Moshe punishing these shepherds and giving them what they really deserved, Moshe said, "Well, let me just emulate what it really looks like to behave like a good person." So Moshe said, "Well, let me start by doing them kindness. I'll show them. This is how a just and kind and good person leads their life." He proceeded to water their sheep to kind of demonstrate This is how you can behave if you choose to. If you want to be a good person, well, this is how you start. Do some kindness to someone else instead of harassing and trying to do dreadful, horrible behavior. Try and do some goodness in your life. And it's so interesting that instead of, you know, going after retribution, Moshe just went to go and lead by example to show them this is how a good person behaves. The daughters go home much earlier than they used to go in because, you know, until that point, they had to sneak around, go really early, and then it was a whole dangerous expedition to give water to the sheep. But now they show up really quickly, and they've left late that day, so they come home, and their father, and we'll get to that in a moment, who it was, but let's go into one opinion. Their father asks them, "What are you doing home so early?" And so they say, "We saw an Egyptian man, and the Egyptian man saved us," and he told the father the story of how their lives were saved. Now, there is an opinion that says that in the verse that talks about them talking to their father, it wasn't actually their father, because their father's name was Yisrael, and in the verse, in the pasuk, it's described as, the name is Reuel, and that's a different name than Yisrael. So some people say Reuel was the father of Yisrael. The goals, Yisrael had 7 daughters, and he also had a father, and the father lived in the house or whatever it was, and he saw his granddaughters all coming home, and he asked them, "Where are you?" And they said, we have this story. He said, "There's a young man, there's 7 unmarried girls in the house. You see an eligible bachelor and you don't even invite him into the house. Go and find him." Some people say that, no, it was Yisrael. It wasn't a grandfather. It was Yisrael himself. Why was he called Reuel? Yisrael had 7 names. We're going to see later on. Later on, when he converts, he's going to take his 7th name, which was Chovav. And Yisrael had a whole bunch of different names, and one of his names was Reuel. Rashi brings down this opinion as well. And therefore, when it says their father, it actually makes more sense. And according to the opinion, by the way, just interestingly enough, according to the opinion that says it was a grandfather, then why in the verse did the girls call him father? And the rabbis say it's not such a problem. Children are happy to call their grandfather father. You know, the children that have a good relationship with their grandfathers, they'll call their grandfather father as well. It's not really a problem that you say, well, it's father and technically it was the grandfather. Whatever the case was, most people seem to follow that it was Yisrael himself. Yisrael himself told his daughters, "Someone was here and someone was so good, go and get them." And there was 2 strong pushes that Yisrael had to bring Moshe into the house. Number one, Yisrael was genuinely a good person. Yes, he was caught up in a lot of idol worship and a lot of magic and a lot of dreadful things, but that was circumstances he never had the chance to experience truth. And when he finally did, he picked himself up and came into the desert to go find truth. And later on, he goes back to Midian and brings his whole family along. But he was also, he was a good person. He was a wonderful person. And some of the rabbis say, why did he want to invite Moshe in? He was like, well, there's a man who just showed up in town, has nowhere to eat, nowhere to drink, because he's a stranger in this land. Invite him over. Bring him in. Let's give him some food and drink. He had no idea who Moshe really was and what Moshe was going to become. He just saw a person that needed help. And he believed in the principle that if you see someone that needs help, you help them. You cast your bread on the water and it always somehow come and pay you back. In Yisrael's case, this was very much true. The amount of blessing that was going to come to Yisrael by way of Moshe is imaginable to describe. Later on, they would say about Yisrael, Yisrael would walk around all day describing how important of a person he was because he was the father-in-law of the king of the Jewish people. He was a father-in-law of Moshe. That was his crowning achievement. A man with more achievements than anyone. His real thing that he prided himself on, and later on in his life, was the only thing he talked about was, "I'm the father-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu. I'm the father-in-law of the king of the Jews." But at this point, he had no idea who it was. He just assumed this was an Egyptian man. He took the girl's word at face value. He had no idea that, according to this opinion, that there was anything more to him. But he said, "An Egyptian man's a stranger here. Go and help him in." Why Egyptian? Well, either because of that example that Moshe told them about the wild donkey. They called him Egyptian after that. They were like, "Oh, that's a cool, cute story." Okay, so we're going to call him an Egyptian man. According to another opinion, he was wearing Egyptian clothing. The same clothing that he had ran away from Egypt with, he still had. And now he was wearing it. I guess when he was sent out of Cush, that was the clothing that he was wearing. And so he comes to the well wearing Egyptian clothing. The well will hold up. This is probably an Egyptian. There's another opinion of why Yisrael was so motivated to get this man to his house. he heard when the daughters were describing the story, they said something very strange. They said when Moshe was drawing the water from the well, the water would rise up towards him as he came to the well. And Yisro thought that very strange because he was a historian. He understood history. And he remembered the story of Rivka. When Rivka had gone to draw the water from the well for the camels of Eliezer, exactly the same thing had happened. All the water rose towards Rivka every time she came to the well. And Eliezer watched that with fascination and understood, okay, this is a very special girl. She definitely merits to join the family of Avraham Avinu and marry Yitzchak. But Yisro knew that story. And now he's saying, this is strange. A phenomena where water in a well is rising up towards the person drawing it. That's a Jewish story. And I've heard that story before. And he understood that possibly this man could be a very great Jewish man. And in that case, he felt he needed to invite this man into his house. The daughters of Yisroi were instructed to go and get Moshe bring to the house. And what's interesting is one of the daughters especially kind of took this task very seriously, and that was Tzipora. Tzipora, spoiler alert, was going to become the wife of Moshe later on. And she, like a bird, and that's actually where the rabbis ask, well, why is she called Tzipora? Tzipora means a bird, literally. So why is she called a bird? And there's a lot of different explanations of why her name is given as a bird. But literally, birds, they pick things up with their beaks and they move things around and they clean up and they make their nests all perfect. When Tzipora understood who Moshe was and then realized that Moshe was coming to the house, firstly, she rushed to go and bring him. And the other thing she did that I guess was bird-like is she got the house ready, not just in the clean sense, which some of the rabbis say that's also what she did, but also she understood that Moshe was holy and Moshe was special and God, and connected so deeply with God, and wouldn't be able to tolerate having any form of idolatry or any form of negativity. And Tzipora went through the house to ensure that there was absolutely no sign of any form of idol worship or an idolatry in the house, so that Moshe would feel comfortable in the house, but also more importantly, that Moshe would feel comfortable with the family. So Moshe comes. They invite Moshe in, and Yisroi asks Moshe, okay, what's your story? Where are you from? Who are you? And Moshe proceeds to tell Yisroi the story of his life. I'm not so sure if he told him the very beginning part of the story. It could be that Yisroi maybe understood what Moshe's original story, if you recognized him as the prince and all. But the part that Moshe told him that got Yisro very concerned, or got Yisro very interested, let's say, was his story in Cush. He told him about his stay in Cush, that he had been a king, that he had taken over Kukinus and become the next king of Cush for 40 years, and then he was honorably discharged, and now he's here. And Yisro knew or believed that there was definitely missing pieces of the story. Who is a king for 40 years of one of the most powerful empires in the world and then suddenly just decides they want to leave? He understood, of course, what Moshe wasn't saying is there was a massive scandal. Something towards the end was so disgusting and so distasteful that the empire of Cush decided that they were going to kick out a 40-year king. He couldn't imagine that Moshe just had decided, okay, I'll agree and I'll leave, or that they had merely just would kick him out. He knew there had to have been a scandal of epic proportion, but how are you going to find out? Cush was so far away. This was a drama he wanted no part of. And he decided, well, I can't kill a man for nothing. I have no idea what had happened. Clearly something really bad had happened. So I'll do an easy trick. I'll put him into jail. I'll lock the door, no food, no drink. If he happens to die, well, okay, that's understandable. But I can't kill him. On the other hand, letting a man like this, who clearly has something really, really bad going on, I can't just let him walk around Midian without any form of control. I have to stop this situation. This is a really bad man we're talking about. So he took Moshe, he threw him into a jail cell, locked the door, threw the keys away, and he was like, okay, now it's not my, whatever happened to this man, now it's not my problem anymore. And so that was that. Moshe was now in the jail with no food or no drink. Moshe spent his time with extreme connection to God, praying and learning. Remember, Moshe was a person who was on the level to receive prophecy. A prophet wasn't merely someone that God just shows up and talks to. In order for a prophet to get prophecy, they had to be on the level of prophecy. Which means that their refinement of their character had to be an extreme level. Their understanding of Torah and their connection to God had to be an extreme level. They had to be a person who God would want to talk to, and then God would choose, can I talk to you or can I not talk to you? Later on, once Moshe actually becomes a prophet, at that point, unlike all the rest of the prophets in history, Moshe didn't just have the character refinement and the excellence and the humility, etc., but Moshe was able to even on demand talk to God whenever he wanted, unlike all other prophets who would only talk to God when God would choose to talk to them. But in order for someone to have any form of prophecy experience, there had to be an extremely high and elevated level. You couldn't just be a person walking down the street and then God saying, okay, I'm going to come and talk to you. It didn't work like that. God only spoke to people that were extremely elevated in all aspects, whether in Torah, whether in character traits, even in the actual body. They had to have a perfect body with no ailments and illnesses and deformities. There had to be a perfect person in every single aspect, which Moshe was. So he was thrown in jail and he was positive and upbeat and joyful because a prophet had to continuously be joyful. Tzipora understood that there was more to this stranger. And she understood that her father had thrown him in the jail and thrown away the key. But Tzipora understood that this person was very special. And another reason why she's called Tzipora is because she snuck in food for 10 years. 10 years Moshe stayed in jail, literally in jail. He was 67 years old. He'd been an empire of one of the most powerful kingdoms in the world for 40 years. And now he is sitting in a jail in Midian. And Tzipora would sneak in water, sneak in bread, and for 10 years she kept Moshe alive, understanding the whole time that this was someone unbelievably special and someone worth saving. And finally, after 10 years, she goes to her father and tells her father, you remember that man that you locked into a jail cell, gave no food and no drink, and you sort of remembered? And he said, what about him? And she said, this man's Jewish, and his ancestor was Abraham. And Abraham was given the choice, bow down to an idol or get thrown into a furnace. And he chose to get thrown into a furnace and he survived. Tzipora tells her father, I have a hunch that this man is probably still alive. And Yisrael, of course, said that's ridiculous. And Tzipora said, you know, this man had Paro's executioner try to chop off his neck and the blade of the axe broke on his neck. He's a holy man. I'm telling you he's still alive. And Tzipora made a challenge for her father. He said, if he's still alive, after 10 years of no food and drink, of course she didn't tell him that she'd been feeding him and drinking him the whole time, but if he's still alive somehow, will you free him? And Yisrael said, yeah, well, if after 10 years of not eating and drinking, he's still alive, well, obviously I misjudged him, and he's a very special person because people need to eat and drink after 10 years, that people don't survive that. So Tzipora said, he's still alive, go and check. So Yisroi went down to the jail cell, and sure enough, Moshe is fully alive. And Yisroi realized he had made a mistake. He had misjudged Moshe. And so he quickly takes Moshe out of the jail cell. He washes him and bathes him and gives him food and drink and clothing, and brings him to his own palace and tells Moshe, you're a free man, I made a mistake. And so Moshe now was inside the palace of Yisroi. And at some point he starts to go for a walk and he goes to the garden. Now when Yisroi had run from Egypt, Yisroi had taken this incredible artifact, this sapphire stick with all these incredible engravings on it and all these incredible mysteries of the secrets of the world engraved onto it. And he wasn't worried about security. He had no insurance plan because Yisroi was a master magician. So all he had done is he had taken the sapphire stick, he'd inserted it into the ground with incredibly deep and powerful magic, and he left it there. And people tried to steal it, but no one could pull it out of the ground. He was so confident that no one could pull the sapphire staff out of the ground. He said, my daughter Tzipora, who's legendary for being beautiful, anyone that's able to pull the stick out of the ground can marry my daughter, no problem. So the strongest men in Midian all showed up and all started to pull and schlep, and they tried everything. And no matter how hard they pulled, they could not get the stick out of the ground. It was, firstly, as I mentioned, it was 650 pounds, but it was more than that. It was trapped there through deep and dark and really serious magic. There was no way to take it out. It was impossible. And Moshe is going through the garden, and something he sees, a sapphire stick. He didn't know anything about the legends of the origin of the stick. He knew nothing about the story of Yisroi stealing. He had no idea what it was. But he comes to the garden, and he sees a sapphire stick, a massive sapphire stick, sticking out of the ground. And as he comes closer, he recognizes the letters. It's Hebrew. He knew Hebrew. His father and his mother taught him when he was a young child. Very young, yes, but Moshe, he didn't age at a regular trajectory. At the age of two, he was far greater than anyone's going to ever be in their entire lifespan. So he recognized the letters. And on the letters, he sees names of God. And he sees Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Ditzach, Adash, Bachav. He sees the 12 sons of Yaakov, the 12 tribes. He sees the forefathers and the four mothers. He starts to recognize all of this, and he's shocked. How is it possible that in the middle of nowhere, far away from Israel and far away from Egypt, there's this incredible artifact with all these incredible letters written on it, including very powerful names of God that are also engraved onto the stick? And Moshe wanted to see it better, so he picked up the sapphire stick and starts to examine it. Moshe was an exceptionally strong man, but it wasn't strength that enabled him to do it. Moshe was Moshe, the most incredible human in history. And so he lifted up the stick, and of course that created a massive drama, and he didn't understand. Why is everyone screaming and shouting and making such a big fuss? He lifted it up. He just wanted to examine it. He didn't realize that it had been trapped there, and it was impossible for anyone to take it out. And of course that created a massive drama. People started screaming and shouting. Look, Moshe is able to take the stick out. Yisro shows up and he's shocked. How is it possible that this stick was taken out of the ground? And at that point, he understood that he had misjudged this young, well, not young man, 77-year-old man who had shown up. And clearly this man was not a bad person or an evil person, but this person was someone incredibly righteous and incredibly great and incredibly powerful on every single level. Now, the condition was to marry Tzipporah. So, of course, Yisro is more than happy to have Moshe marry his daughter because Moshe was worthy on so many levels. And Tzipporah was thrilled as well because Tzipporah understood who Moshe was and Tzipporah wanted to be married. It's interesting, though, when you look at the many sources that talk about the righteousness of Tzipporah. And unlike other famous women, and there were so many great and famous women in Jewish history, very few of them are compared directly to Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. Very few of them. Because Sarah, Rivka, and Rachel, Leah, the mothers of the Jewish people, they're in a league of their own. One of them, who's compared to them, is Tzipporah. Her righteousness was unparalleled, unmatched. And she's literally compared to Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. Moshe married her. And at the wedding, Yisro called Moshe over, and they had a serious discussion. Yisro said, I know your history. I know your story. Your great-great-great-grandfather, Yaakov, went to his father-in-law, Laban, and then one day, without saying a word, vanished. And that was it. He took everyone with him, and they never saw them again. I'm making a deal with you. You want to marry my daughter? You want to have the wedding to continue? That's fine. The only condition is you ask permission before you leave. You don't just vanish without saying a word. You need to ask permission. If you get permission, then you could go. But other than that, just to pick up and disappear, like your great-great-great-great ancestor, that you're not allowed to do. And Moshe agreed to those terms, which is interesting how it's connected later on with the story, which we're not going to cover here. But Moshe did agree to those terms. Whether he actually had to hold himself to those terms once God instructed him to leave is a different question entirely. But Moshe did keep his word. He did come back to his father-in-law and did ask permission when it was time for him to leave. But Yisro was very concerned about that. And again, you just see how both Moshe and Yisro had a very good understanding of history, and they both wanted to, you know, make sure that the mistakes of history weren't repeated, weren't copied over. So Yisro made that condition with Moshe to ensure that Moshe didn't disappear one day. One other note that's, I guess, interesting but tragic as well. The entire time, Moshe hadn't sent any word to Egypt. He had no idea what was going on. This is before, you know, the electronics and communications like we have today. Moshe's father had died a few years after he left. The entire time when Moshe was gone, it was his older brother Aaron that was leading the Jewish people. For over 50 years, the leader of the Jewish people was his older brother, which is such an interesting fact when you get later on in the story and you understand that Moshe then became the leader. He'd been missing. He shows up and he takes the position, and his older brother gladly gave him his position, which is, again, shows you just the beautifulness between the relationship of these two brothers. But the whole time, Moshe wasn't aware that his father had already passed away. So as far as he was concerned, his father was not young at all. But still, as far as he was concerned, his father was still alive. He didn't know until later on by the burning bush that his father had actually passed away. But in that time, while he was in Midian, the paroi that had oppressed him and the two Jewish informants that had gotten him into so much trouble, paroi had died, in a brutal, dreadful way, a way that he really deserved. He had a dreadful case of leprosy, and his whole body broke out into the worst bruises, and he actually died. What really was the trigger was him coming to visit the Jewish people, to add into the persecution, and along the way, visiting the Jewish people, his carriage had overturned, his chariot had overturned, and he died in the most dreadful, painful way that such a wicked person really deserves. Of course, he was replaced by an equally worse monster, but at the same time, he died, which meant that Moshe's biggest threats, the reason why he was avoiding Egypt, once he arrived in Midian, was no longer a threat. But he still stayed. He became officially a shepherd of his father-in-law, and a short while later, he had his first son. This boy, the Zohar writes, and I think Yom Kippur Shemini writes it as well, this boy was the first son to join the family in many years. Yisrael had seven daughters, but it sounds like it was a girl's family for many, many years. And finally, when Moshe had a child, it was a very, very big milestone for the entire Yisrael family, because they finally had a boy that had joined the family. The first boy that had joined was, he named Gershom. Righteous people, when they have incredible and wonderful things happen in their life, they always attribute it to God. And they always want to remind themselves that this wonderful thing is something that came from God. So a lot of times you'll see with righteous and great men that they'll name their children after wonderful things that have happened in their life, as a continual reminder of a milestone, thanking God for the incredible kindness that they did. Moshe marveled. He said, when strangers come to a land, they're always treated the worst. No one wants to see a stranger show up in their city and be more wealthy and more successful than them. People will go out of their way to make strangers have a disastrous time in their city, because no one wants to say, this guy shows up in their city and suddenly he's having such a successful time. People will make the stranger's life miserable. And Moshe was having a successful time now, and he was so grateful to God that in spite of the fact that he was a stranger, he was still finding success. And so he named his son to thank God for that. His second son, however, was thanking God for delivering him from the hands of, from the sword of Pare. An obvious question is, wait a second, the second son was born long after Moshe was saved from the hand of Pare. So one opinion says, it's actually Pare died at that point, and Moshe heard about this, and he said, well, now I finally get to thank God for Pare's death. The two people that had informed on him losing all their power and losing all their money, they were like paupers, so they were essentially dead too. But another opinion is that Moshe didn't want to announce to the entire Midian that he was a fugitive, that he had been supposed to have his head chopped off by Pare, but a miracle had happened and that his neck turned into marble and he escaped execution. It would look very bad for him. So his first son, he was going to name him that, but then he said, well, it's not going to look too great. How about I find another miracle that God did to me, and I'll name my first son Gershom. By the time he came to the second son, he'd already understood that he was on his way out. At that point, he's like, okay, well, you know, to letting people know that I'm a convict, when I'm about to head back to Egypt, I don't really care anymore what people think and you know, how bad it'll look for me, and I guess for Yisrael's family too. So, you know, now that he was gone and he wasn't reminding people of the fact that he was a convict with him and his sons walking around, he was confident naming his son Eliezer. The one final note that we'll finish off, because the rest of the story is now going to be starting. Moshe's life is now going to take a brand new turn. He's going to become a prophet. He's going to talk to God by the burning bush. And he's no longer going to be a shepherd in Midian for Yisrael. He's going to become the greatest and the most incredible Jewish man and Jewish prophet and Jewish hero that has ever existed and that ever will exist. But one final, let's call it, interesting information that kind of connects to Moshe's life before he became a prophet was his son Eliezer. This son was a very special son, and Moshe later on, as a prophet, he tells God, he says, if you don't forgive the Jewish people, wipe my name out of the Torah. God says, I want to make you into a nation of your own. I'll get rid of all the Jewish people, says God initially, and I'll make the Jewish people come through you. And Moshe said, I won't have it on my watch. Forgive the Jewish people, otherwise wipe me out of the Torah. And Hashem said, you threaten for me to wipe me out of the Torah. One parsha, 1 week worth of Torah, I won't have your name in it. And of course, the rabbis explained that Moshe had even greater level instead of calling Moshe by his name, which is kind of limited, it calls him you, which is so much deeper and more personal, because God just appreciated how much Moshe loved the Jewish people. But also, Moshe had threatened something, and in words of a righteous person, it lasts. But also in the flip side, God had promised Moshe that a nation would come from him. That also had to be fulfilled somehow. And the rabbis point to a very interesting situation that happened with Moshe's second son. And they say, yeah, it actually happened. Moshe wanted to name his son Eliezer. Moshe had a vision about a future Eliezer. And he begged God, this future Eliezer, let him be one of my descendants. And Hashem agreed and he named his son Eliezer. And in the 1,000 years later, his descendant became this famous Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. But his son Eliezer had only one child. One child, Rechavia. And Rechavia, on the other hand, even though he's one child, a son of Moshe had two sons, his second son only had one son. From that child, by the time it hit the time of King David, he had 60,000 descendants. He had so many people that continued the line from Moshe, and they were all the tribe of Levi. They were all Levim. They all worked in the Beis HaMikdash, so those that were able to. And by the time of King David, the family of Moshe was so unbelievably large, all as a continuation of the second son, Eliezer, of the second son of Moshe. And Eliezer himself only had one son, which is so tremendous. Sometimes people are always counting numbers. And in the case of Moshe, his second son had one son, and somehow that family became so unbelievably large so many years later.